Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Freeform, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Stephen Greenhouse, who covered labor in the workplace for 19 years at the New York Times. We're going to talk about his latest book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Now, many of you have heard what I'm about to say before. It's kind of the preamble to a lot of what we talk about. But the years from the end of World War II through the early 1970s are thought of by many as America's golden age. Though these were not the best of times for people of color, women, or the environment, just to name a few, employment was solid and reliable. A family could survive on one salary. The U.S. was leader of the world in many categories, and at the core of all of it was the greatest middle class the world had ever seen. Two things many either don't know or don't want to talk about at that time. Taxes were high, really high at times, and unions were strong. As a nation, we were prosperous, and perhaps because we'd gone through the Depression and World War II together, we shared that prosperity. Well, two things happened in 1970 that set us on a course that broke that social compact. Milton Friedman in the New York Times op-ed declared that the sole purpose of corporate behavior was to enhance shareholder value. An attorney and soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell wrote the Powell Memo, advocating that business redefine its relationship to politics and government and seek every possible advantage. Both of these ideas were adopted and executed with a vengeance, and it is no coincidence that the U.S. has the weakest worker voice of any industrial nation and also the greatest income inequality. I've taken it as a given for decades that the labor movement in America, especially in the private sector, is losing members, power, salary and conditions, and that it's only getting worse and that the country suffers because of it. The weakening of unions pushed the Democrats toward Wall Street for money and paved the way for Donald Trump. So, two big questions loom over this conversation for me. First, given how clearly labor unions improved employment conditions for hundreds of millions of laborers, why did those same workers surrender to the corporate government plan to eliminate those unions? And two, what do we do about it? Can our shared vulnerability and experience of the pandemic and its destruction of the economy echo that post-war experience I talked about? Are these two simultaneous crises big enough to open the door for real change where labor is concerned? And if so, how do we best take advantage and walk through those doors? Stephen Greenhouse was a reporter for the New York Times from 1983 to 2014 and covered labor in the workplace for 19 of those years. He also served as a business and economics reporter and a diplomatic and foreign correspondent. He's the author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, and his latest, now in paperback, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Welcome, Stephen Greenhouse, to Freeform, a world that just might work.
Very nice to be here, Terrence.
Great. And let me tell people we're recording this conversation Tuesday, February 9th. So my first question lately to all is, how are you? How are you coping with the pandemic? Where are you? All that sort of thing.
I'm in New York. I tell people the one advantage of being over 65 years old is I've gotten my shot. And as they say in Hamilton, don't throw away your shot. And I tried very quickly to get it. And they keep saying that with the pandemic in theory receding, there are bluer skies ahead. But things keep going wrong and crazy, so I'm still waiting for things to get better. It's good that Donald Trump is no longer president, and Biden is doing a lot of things that many progressives, many people who want less income inequality, many people who want an end to wage stagnation, have been pulling for years. He's been pushing for higher $15 minimum wage. He's been pushing for laws to make it easier to unionize. So, you know, things I feel are really promising for workers. And I wrote many, many times about how Donald Trump made believe he was a friend of workers, but he did dozens and dozens of anti-worker things, you know, from not doing anything to raise the minimum wage to not really issuing any new rules to protect workers against COVID. So I think in many ways, now is a more promising time for American workers.
Yeah. And do you share, since we're talking about now as the moment now, do you share the reference that I made in the introduction that perhaps us going through these crises, this economic crisis, this health crisis, and so on, together, and workers being so obviously in the line of fire, may actually move things, create a mood, an appetite for some real change.
Yes and no. I think the appetite for real change is there. I mean, you know, I've been writing about labor now for like, you know, since the mid-1990s, 25 years now. And I've never seen so much public support and recognition of, you know, invisible workers, low-wage workers, essential workers, whatever you want to call them, whether they're grocery workers or fast food workers or janitors or bus drivers. People see that these are the folks who make our economy work day to day, not the Goldman Sachs and hedge fund folks. And people see that these folks, the bus drivers, the subway conductors, you know, the Trader Joe's cashiers, the, you know, the Walmart stockers, they put their lives literally on the line every day going in and making $10, $11, $12, $8 an hour. So I think there's real appreciation for these workers. And I haven't seen specific public polls, but I imagine there's more public support of lower wage essential workers than there has been in decades. So yes, there is appreciation, maybe momentum. However, as we've seen for the past 40, 50 years, you know, corporate America fights very, very hard against any push to raise wages, any push to make it easier to unionize. You know, look at Amazon, you know, a phenomenally successful company. It's made a ton of money during the pandemic. And it is fighting tooth and nail to stop a unionization drive at its warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, outside Birmingham. And, you know, Amazon says, we pay these workers very well, $15, $15.30 an hour. And these workers work their butts off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you hear these stories about how, you know, these workers work so insanely hard. And they say, you know, $15, we should be making $20, $25 an hour. So on the one hand, I think a lot of the public sympathizes with these essential workers and thinks that they deserve hazard pay, hero pay, or just a raise. But, you know, corporate America, which believes in profit maximization and maximizing share price, you know, doesn't really buy into that. And they, you know, they are not eager to give big raises. They're not eager to, you know, they'll fight tooth and nail against workers unionizing because they want to have the power. They want to be able to make all the decisions they want without workers, without a union interfering. So yes, there's momentum, but corporate America is resisting. Now, one hopeful sign, Terrence, is, so we have a new president. And Joe Biden said, I will be the most pro-union president you've ever seen. And so far, you know, he's been, you know, pushing for the so-called PRO Act, which is an act which would make it far easier for workers to unionize in, you know, 30, 50 different ways. But there's this little problem called a filibuster. So if Biden had his way, it would be enacted, but he's not going to be able to get 60 votes in the Senate to enact it, which creates a problem. And, you know, one of the big questions we as a nation face right now is, will Biden and Democrats be willing to try to get rid of the filibuster? And even if they try, will they be able to? But, you know, if we want to make things better for workers, if we want a $15 minimum wage, if we want, you know, stronger laws, safety and health laws, or laws barring non-compete clauses, or, you know, we have to, you know, it's very hard to enact those unless we get rid of the filibuster. So that's, you know, that's a key issue we face as a nation if we want to make things better for workers. And even basic things, Terrence, like, you know, we, the United States, though the world's wealthiest nation, is the only industrial nation that doesn't guarantee all workers paid sick days.
Yeah.
Doesn't guarantee all workers paid parental leave. Doesn't, you know, we are one of like four countries in the world that don't guarantee paid maternity leave. We, you know, we don't have any laws guaranteeing paid vacation in the 27 nations of the European Union. Every worker is guaranteed at least 4 weeks vacation. So things are really broken for workers. And unfortunately, one of the two major political parties really doesn't want to do anything serious to help workers because their corporate donors are unhappy with that. And they don't want to face any mandates that will raise costs. And one of the main points I make in my recent book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, is that there's something very broken in the United States. And that's workers have far too little power, workers have far too little voice, corporations and wealthy donors have disproportionate power. And as a result, we remain this weirdly anti-worker country, you know, where workers don't have paid sick days, don't have paid vacation, you know, don't have laws guaranteeing paid parental leave, paid sick days, paid vacation. We're the only industrial country in the world that doesn't have universal health coverage. I mean, for workers, things are unfortunately very broken. And the reason they haven't gotten better is that I submit corporations and the rich maintain such a major hold on power. In my book, I explore various ways that workers have been somewhat successful in pushing back about corporations to build a fairer economy. The 5 for 15 has really gotten 9 states now to enact laws to bring a $15 minimum wage. They've come a long way since the 5 for 15 first began in 2012. The teacher strikes in West Virginia, in Oklahoma, in Arizona, in Los Angeles, in Chicago, you know, they have really helped right the ship. Things were too often tilted unfavorably towards students and teachers, and especially in these red states, Arizona, That's Oklahoma, right. West Virginia, they made things much fairer for students, for teachers. They got the right-wing legislatures to increase school budgets and improve the teacher-student ratio. So there is hope, but it's still a long fight.
Yeah, I want to cover so many different things, but let's just go to that one of the things you mentioned, which was those strikes. West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona. These are not the places where you expect strikes to happen. This is not. How did that happen? And what's the best lessons we can draw from it?
Sure. Great question, Terrence. So I think a lot of, you know, we who live on the coasts where it's largely Democratic, the governments are largely Democratic, often don't realize what has been happening in the heartland, whether West Virginia or Oklahoma, that these are very bright red. And that means the state legislatures, often the governors, are elected largely through corporate money and wealthy donors, the Koch Brothers Network, Americans for Prosperity. And so when these conservative Republicans take over state government, and when they took over the state government in West Virginia and Kentucky, one of the very first things they did once Republican control was established over both houses of the legislature for the first time is the Great Depression, they pass a famous anti-union law, right to work law. So they're trying to weaken the voice of unions. They're trying to weaken the voice of workers. And also, and this is true in West Virginia, where the first big teacher strike happened, in Oklahoma and Arizona, all where these huge teacher strikes happened, the legislatures passed tax breaks for corporations. They passed tax breaks for the wealthiest people in the state. And in all three states, they passed tax breaks for fracking. And the teachers see all this happening, and they are unhappy that, you know, there are all these tax cuts, which means there isn't much left in the budget for everything else. And they say, you know, what's going on here? This stinks. We're not getting raises. We're not getting more money for the schools. Many teachers who live in Arizona are going to teach in California to make $30,000 more a year. Teachers in Oklahoma are crossing the border to Texas and making far more money. Teachers in West Virginia are crossing the border and teaching in Maryland and making $20,000-$30,000 a year. So suddenly these states have this huge teacher shortage because these corporate tax cuts, these huge tax cuts means there's not enough money for education. So the teachers say, this sucks, we gotta stand up and fix it. And they really were unable to kind of, in the face of so much corporate money and dark money, it's hard for them to win control of the legislature. So they fought back by going on strike. And they kind of forced the red state legislatures to wake up and see how their austerity budgets and tax cuts for the rich were screwing students, were screwing teachers, were making these insane class sizes where 35, 40 students per teacher, where kids were caught, were using books that were 20, 30, 40 years old. So, you know, West Virginia, you know, these two teachers really started the whole movement. They were sick and tired of because of the austerity state budget, the teachers are required to pay thousands and thousands of dollars more per year towards the health coverage under the state health plan. And it's amazing seeing a few workers with vision banding together, forming these Facebook pages, and really mobilizing thousands of people. It is like the days of the 1930s and the mm-hmm. great union organizers like John L. Lewis and Walter Reuther. You know, these individuals in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, you know, a handful of individuals got the ball rolling and resulted in walkout strikes by tens of thousands of people. And they generally won raises, they won increased spending on education. And I think the teachers, because they're such a respected part of the population, they were like one of the few groups in society that had the ability, the power to stand up to these conservative Republican governors and legislatures. And they used their voice as workers, they used their protests, they used their red for Ed shirts to make a very loud statement that in ways changed those states and changed labor history and made people realize, hey, you know, there's been all this talk about unions being dormant, but look what the hell happened in West Virginia and Charleston and in Phoenix and in Oklahoma City, these huge strikes, and later in Los Angeles and more recently in Chicago. So I think what's happened with the teachers, it really awakened workers across the nation and kind of paved the way for the essential workers to be mm-hmm. more emboldened about standing up and speaking out because they saw what was happening with teachers. And I should also add, Terrence, you know, there's the Black Lives Matter movement and the women's movement, the Me Too movement and the environmental movement. There's been a lot of activism on many fronts in recent years, the DACA movement. And I think that is also helping embolden workers.
Just the fact that public protests, public demonstration, public uprisings are kind of, they're happening. They're back again.
Yeah. You know, I read one article that said like one fourth of high school students in the nation have participated in some type of protest, whether a gun control protest or an environmental protest or a Me Too protest or an anti-Trump protest. And like, you know, one might say that's a very promising statistic that, you know, these young people are like standing up and getting used to not putting up with all this unfairness, inequity, BS, you know, global warming. And, I'm sure many parents and teachers and government officials saying, you're young, just mm-hmm. Just shut up and not say anything. But I think a lot of students have a great sense of what's fair and unfair. And Greta Thunberg, you know, has really done an amazing job educating kids and emboldening kids and inspiring kids. And that's all been good.
You know, it's interesting, as you were saying, you said one fourth? Was that the number?
I think it was one-fifth or one-fourth.
One-fifth or one-fourth. But still, what I was thinking was you and I came through college in late 60s, early 70s, time of great activism. But nothing like that had happened in our high schools. High school was still a pretty, I was a, flat top jock kind of guy. You know, I mean, high schools were still very much in control. And it was not till you got to college or you broke away that people got active. So I think that's very promising.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, one of the great things about the teacher strikes, Terrence, is so a lot of people say one of the big problems with labor unions in the United States in recent decades is people see them as selfish, as only mm-hmm. wanting to, you know, get a 8% raise while other people are struggling to get a 2% raise. And that unions really have to show the community that they're part of the community and they want to lift the community. And one of the great things about the teacher strikes, it's like the Los Angeles teacher strike. Before it began, I think the teachers were offered, I think, a 6% raise over 3 years, maybe a 7%. And the teachers were also asking for better student-teacher ratios, more school librarians, more school counselors, I think more school therapists, more green space for kids. And so they, you know, went on strike really with the demands being more to help the kids than to help themselves. So they went on strike for a week. It was an incredibly rainy week in Los Angeles, I remember. and they were drowning, poured upon. And the strike ends. The teachers win most of what they were asking. They get more librarians, more school counselors, more green space for kids, more school therapists. But they agreed to the same raise that was offered them before the strike began, the 6%. So that showed that we, and the Chicago Teachers Union has done the exact same thing. They're showing we as a union are using our power not so much just to help ourselves. So don't call us selfish union SOBs. We're right. trying to do to create a fairer society. And there's this concept that's really come to the fore in recent years called bargaining for the common good, where unions unions realize that they're not as strong as they want as they were 20 and 30 and 40 years ago. So they're like really reaching out to community groups and African American groups and immigrant groups and Asian American groups. Like, we all have to work together to create a better society, and we'll help you on this fight. We'll help families get more green space for the kids to play at schools, and better student teacher ratios. And someday, you know, when we're really up against the wall fighting for raises or something, you know, please, you know, scratch our back and help us. So this bargaining for the common good is this very important way of strengthening unions. I remember Randy Weingarten said that that community, you know, our ties, our relationships, our partnership with the community is the new union density. When unions represented 35% of the nation's workers and 60 and 70% in some cities, that union density was real power.
Yeah, it was union membership was the same as union density.
Yeah. So when, you know, so now we're down to union density nationwide is down to basically 1 in 10 workers, down from 1 in 3 workers. And so now to really have the power of old, unions are realizing that forming bonds, relationships with the community, with community partners, is in effect the new density, the new power.
Well, I must say, I live in Los Angeles and Long Beach, but basically LA County. And when those strikes were happening, what you pointed out was clearly the message. The message, as I recall, it seemed to me it was more about class size and the ability to actually do their job and deliver education to these kids that they were striking for. And if that was the message I got, you know, from the newspapers, from commentary and so on, that seems to me to be a real solid message and solid movement.
And that's in liberal lefty LA. I mean, like, take Phoenix, you know, conservative Phoenix. There are these pictures of like 70,000 people marching one day during the Red for Ed strike. It wasn't just teachers. It was parents. It was students. And when we talk about 1 in 4, 1 in 5 high school students taking to the streets, you know, one of the things they marched in was some of these teacher strikes because they supported the teachers because the teachers weren't just trying to get an extra 1.3% on their paycheck. They're trying to make sure there was more money for schools.
It's interesting you use the term, a term that I use as well, this term broken. The labor movement is broken, or workers in America, their you know, their solidarity, their welfare is broken. In the back of my mind when I'm putting these conversations together, I often ask myself, it's broke, let's fix it. One, what's the evidence that it's broken, whatever it is, in this case, labor, right? Two, how did it get broken? What's the history? Who are the culprits? And three, how do we fix it? What are the solutions? And I, if you can, I'll perfectly accept that if you say, you know what, I can't off the top of my head, but we've talked in sort of macro things, paid family leave, vacation times, salaries, membership, organizing, but you also, you focus on individuals to provide the evidence that things are broken. Could you cite, you know, two or three of those?
Sure. I mean, first, I say that the system is broken for workers because it is so massively anti-worker in so many ways. You know, when you take, you know, there's something called the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is kind of the rich nations club, 35 nations.
OECD,
you know,
right?
Yeah. OECD. So among those 35 wealthy nations, the United States has the third highest percentage of low-wage workers. Again, we are the wealthiest nation on earth, but we're the third highest ratio of low wage workers. Again, you know, as I say, and we're the only one without laws guaranteeing paid sick days, paid vacation, paid parental leave. So I say the system is broken for workers. I mean, in any other country, in the United States, if you work for a factory or a call center and it closes and 500, 800 people get laid off, all of them could lose their health coverage.
Right.
And their families too. That doesn't happen in any other industrial country, whether it's England or France or Germany or Japan, is that they have universal health coverage. So like you're not, your health plan is not screwed if your the factory where you work, if the call center where you work closes. So that's what I'm talking about. The system is broken for workers in America. Now, one of the reasons it's broken is that unfortunately, the power of unions, the voice of workers in the United States has been shrunken. I say, you know, the labor movement is shrunken more than broken. And there are many reasons for that. But the overwhelming reason is that, and I explain chapter and verse of this in my book.
Yes.
Is that corporations fight harder against unions, are more hostile to unions than is the case in any of the 35 other OECD wealthy industrial nations. You know, there's something in America, you know, American corporations see, I was a reporter covering the economy in Europe for 5 years for the New York Times, and whether I was in Germany or Switzerland or Sweden or Italy or Spain, companies deal with unions. They see unions as, maybe they don't love unions, but they see labor unions as legitimate institutions that we, the company, we, the corporate executives, have to partner with, hold hands with, to create increased profits and increased prosperity. In the United States, there's a very different view of unions. It's like unions are the enemy. Unions aren't even legitimate. We, the corporations, have the right to try to stomp them to death. And that's what's slowly been happening in the United States over the last 30, 40 years. So corporations have really been trying to strangle unions. And so that's one of the reasons we've seen percentage of workers in unions go from 35% now down to 10.8%.
And let me jump in for 1 second. That's when you say that 10.8%, that's including public service workers. If you go to private sector, it's around 6.2.
Yeah, it's one in 16 workers in the private sector is in a union. And corporations make it so hard to form a union. And you know, we all have friends who've gone to business school. Many of us do. And like I think in business school they're taught unions suck. You don't want a union where you work because, you know, the first thing you want as an executive is autonomy and flexibility. Mm-hmm. And God forbid the workers were to have a union. God forbid the workers would have a voice in some decisions about, you know, line speed, production speed. Well, that's terrible for you as a manager because you no longer have full autonomy. You no longer can do everything you want. So, you know, there's something about the mind of American business executives that they just don't want to deal with unions, don't want to tolerate with unions, and they fight tooth and nail to keep to get rid of unions. Now, I should be clear, unions aren't all perfect. I mean, there's been way too much discrimination against African-American workers, way too much discrimination against women workers, way too much corruption against unions, especially 20, 30, 40 years ago. But unions have generally gotten much less corrupt. There's much less discrimination against women, against African-American workers. You know, some of the nation's largest unions, the Service Employees Union, the National Education Association, the American Federation of Teachers, they're headed by women.
Yeah.
And some of the largest unions are headed by African-Americans, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. So unions have got, you know, they saw that it was bad for them, bad for society, for them to discriminate, and they've gotten much better and much fairer. And I think they see that's important to bring workers of color and immigrants and women aboard if they're going to gain strength and if they're going to really try to do their best to lift, especially workers at the bottom, the essential workers, you know, who complain that they're not being protected enough against COVID, whether at Amazon warehouses or meatpacking plants.
Okay, let me tell people this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Stephen Greenhouse. He covered labor in the workplace for 19 years at the New York Times, and we're talking about his latest book now out in paperback, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Let me just lay a couple of numbers that I've taken from your work. One is that we've talked about the union membership has dropped, but union power in terms of elections. In the 2015-2016 election cycle, business outspent unions 16 to 1, $3.4 billion to $213 million, according to the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. And each year, the nation's unions spend about $48, $50 million lobbying in Washington, while corporate America spends more than $2.5 billion, 50 times as much. So when we know that the wealthy and the wealthy corporations get their way in American democracy, the study by the professor from Northwestern, the one from Princeton, and I never remember their names, but they found that when something the people favored was not favored by the wealthy, it had next to no chance of passing. That if something the people favored actually passed, it was because the wealthy also favored it. And but that number about how business outspends unions, and if we go back to the 60s, the early 70s, this was very different. There were countervailing forces. That great American middle class that I talked about in the introduction was the result of a back and forth between workers and corporations. And now it has for decades now been a one-sided game.
True. I think the system is broken for workers, and I think you're making that case. You know, unions wish they could spend $3 billion a year on lobbying,
yeah.
But they don't have that type of money, and corporate America has kind of infinite amounts of money. And you asked me to talk about, give an example of how the system is broken for workers. I write about several fast food workers in my book. Terrence Wise, a fast food worker in Kansas City. He was working for Burger King and Pizza Hut. He worked two full-time jobs.
Ugh.
And he would leave work. You know, he told me, and I slipped, you know, he'd leave for work around 6:30 in the morning before his three daughters had awakened to go to school. He'd work at Burger King for maybe 7:30 to 3:30, then he'd go to his Pizza Hut job, and he'd get home, you know, 12:30 in the morning after his daughters had gone to bed. And he said, you know, from Monday through Friday, I didn't see my kids because I was working so hard. And his, fiance, they weren't actually married, was a home care aide, and she got hurt lifting a patient at one point and couldn't work for 6 weeks, 2 months. And so suddenly she had no money coming in. And although Terrence Wise was working two full-time jobs, they could no longer pay their rent, and they became homeless. And
oh,
they
my
moved
God.
moved in with her brother. So it's, you know, it just, you know, people talk about, oh, if we have a $15 minimum wage, you know, business talks about if we have a $15 minimum wage, it's the end of the world. It's so unfair. But you look at these people who really are working very, very, very hard. And, you know, if you're making $7.25 an hour or $8 an hour, it really is hard to live in the United States. And I try to, I talk about the OECD, our minimum wage, and what it buys is lower than the minimum wage in Canada, Germany, and France, and Britain comparatively. So we have a very low minimum wage. And business says, well, we can't raise the minimum wage. You know, it will force people out of business. It will cause some unemployment. But a lot of, you know, but you ask low-wage workers, they, you know, 98% of them want a higher minimum wage. They realize there's a risk of some people being laid off, but they think it will really improve our lives, and that's the right thing to do. And, you know, the minimum wage has not increased since 2009. This is the longest stretch in American history since the minimum wage was first enacted in 1938. The longest stretch in American history that we've had no increase in the minimum wage. Why is that? It isn't because Barack Obama didn't try to enact a higher minimum wage. It's because the Republican Party and its corporate donors have repeatedly blocked a higher minimum wage. And while Donald Trump would say he's the best president workers ever had,
yeah,
he didn't lift a finger to raise the minimum wage. So, you know, the point is, you know, worker power, there's this huge imbalance that worker power in the U.S. is too weak. And that's why I wrote this book, Beaten Down, Worked Up. I think a lot of Americans, especially young Americans, fail to understand this fact that things are out of whack. The things are broken for workers, that corporations have far too much power. Policy is skewed way in their favor, and, you know, far worse than in Europe, far worse than Japan, far worse than in Australia and Canada. And then American workers are kind of systematically screwed on wages, on paid sick days, on paid vacation, on universal health coverage, and on having a voice at work. You know, in France, 98% of the workers are covered by collective bargaining agreements. In Italy, 98. And in Italy, it's 90%. In Sweden, it's like 90%. In Germany, it's 56%. And that means the workers have power. They collectively pressure corporations across the board for a fairer deal. Of all the industrial nations, the United States has the lowest percentage. Only 12% of workers are covered by collective bargaining agreements. And that is one indication of how weak worker power is in the United States.
Well, wait. Can we jump in?
Sure.
That middle question, how did it happen? Which is the one that I sort of posed in the introduction to, is how were the corporations able to take what at one point was 35%, which meant that we were not out of whack with the rest of the world, and it meant that, for instance, the Democratic Party, which relied on unions and workers as, you know, one of their main constituencies, things were more balanced. What was the game plan and why did it succeed? I mean, we know corporations, I cited the Powell memo and so on, we know they decided, whoa, we got to change things, but why were they so successful?
Okay, there are probably 10 different reasons. Let me see. So I think, so as I explained in my book, things were good for workers and unions in the 1950s and 1960s when unions were strongest and there were these important strikes and important partnerships between labor and management that really played a pivotal role in creating the world's largest, richest middle class. And,
yep.
And the United Auto Workers, United Steel Workers, Ford Motor, General Motors, U.S. Steel, these kind of really led the way in providing better pay and setting a model that created the middle class. All these other companies, whether union or non-union, said, hey, United States Steel is paying all that. GM is paying all that. We have to pay much better, too, to attract workers. Fast forward to 1980. There was like a triple whammy for workers and unions in the United States. One was this horrible recession, which at that point was the worst recession since 1930, 1929. And we saw a ton of factory closings. And so that was one thing. And then second, really around 1980, we saw a huge burst in globalization and the rise of imports and American corporations increasingly moving production to Mexico or China or Vietnam or Sri Lanka. And so that also resulted in many factory closings. And remember, factory work, manufacturing, was the heart of the labor movement. And then we saw all these, the third thing that really started to rise in 1980 was all this anti-union sentiment among corporate leaders. And kind of what most inspired them was in 1981, President Reagan faced a strike from the air traffic controllers. And it was an illegal strike. I would argue it was a dumb strike. It played right into Reagan's hands. It really was a make my day moment to make Reagan look like a conservative hero. They were engaged in an illegal strike. He fired the 11,300 air traffic controllers and defeated the strike. And Reagan really emboldened corporate leaders across the nation to take a much tougher stance toward unions. And we saw Greyhound and Phelps Dodge, Copper Company, many companies were just, you know, using scabs to defeat unions and labor disputes. And so between the pressure of globalization and this increased anti-union sentiment, aggressiveness by companies, unions are in ways trapped that, you know, if you fight too hard for a raise, if you go on strike for a larger raise, that will just increase the likelihood that your employer will move the factory to China or to Mexico or to Honduras or wherever. So globalization really hurt unions at the same time that this increased anti-union sentiment hurt unions. And also at the same time, Terrence, was the growth of the service sector, the manufacturing sector, and you know, banks and nail salons and beauty parlors and restaurants. And they were harder to unionize. You know, it's harder to unionize Goldman Sachs than it is to unionize a
steel
mill or order plant. Yeah. So, you know, the rise of the service sector, of course, resulted also in a smaller percentage of workers and unions. Although in Germany, you know, the service sector is highly unionized. Much more of retail, much more of restaurants are unionized than the United States. And I think, you know, another reason that the percentage of workers in unions has declined is that, you know, unions are too often asleep at the wheel. They weren't aggressive enough in trying to organize. And I'd say, you know, that problem was biggest in the service sector. You know, there wasn't, unions were far too slow to try to unionize Walmart and Target and Kohl's and all these big retailers, too slow to unionize many restaurants. And then it's been the growth of franchising, which makes it harder to unionize, and the growth of independent contractors makes it harder to unionize. Subcontracts makes it hard to unionize. There are all these American corporations have like these 50 strategies,
right?
You know, to try to make
whack-a-mole.
It harder to unionize. You whack them all. You know, so like a lot of drivers at Uber would like to form a union, but the companies argue, and some government entities agree, well, they're independent contractors, they're not regular employees, and under federal law, independent contractors are considered independent business persons and thus can't unionize because they unionize to demand higher wages. It's considered an antitrust violation. All these independent business persons gathering together to demand, to set wages, to fix wages. So maybe someday the National Labor Relations Board will declare that all these Uber drivers, they're employees, and despite what Prop 22 says in California,
right?
But under federal law, the National Labor Relations Board might say all these Uber drivers, Lyft drivers, DoorDash deliverers, they should be considered employees. And under federal law, if you're considered an employee, then you have the right to unionize.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Because that, I mean, the question always after the fact, you know, sort of in hindsight, it's go, well, wait a minute, how could they let that happen? How could we let that happen? But when you point out, it was a number of things at once that corporations were quicker and better at taking advantage of than unions were able to see what was happening and fight back.
And you used the word before, Terrence, that unions surrendered, labor surrendered. I would argue with that. They were bulldozed more than they surrendered.
Yeah. Yeah.
They fought back. Did they fight back as mightily, as ably, as cleverly as they might have? No. But a lot of them fought back and lost because, again, the United States is the only industrial nation in the world, you know, among the 35, where if workers go on strike, management has the right to replace strikers permanently. And no other country can they do that. So, like, people are really scared of going on strike because they figure, oh, God, management could replace me permanently. I could lose my job.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are many, many, and talk about how tilted the playing field is. So, you know, look at the Amazon organizing drive going on right now in
Alabama.
Yeah. There's, you know, like some of the organizing drives that went on in California and some of the big warehouses in the Inland Empire, right?
Right.
You know, so management can propagandize 24 hours a day, can have videos in the break room, can have flyers in the bathroom saying unions stink, unions only want your money, unions are corrupt. And under American law, corporations have 100% right to prohibit union organizers from even setting foot in the parking lot and putting a flyer on a worker's windshield. So things are really tilted. So when people ask, you know, how did it come to pass that we've gone from 35% of the workforce union members to just 10%? It's partly because the law is so tilted, and it enables the corporations to win repeatedly in keeping out unions because they're so aggressive. And the law and other there have been studies, Terrence, showing that the rank and file workers who lead a unionization drive, and they're so key, and like they're the quarterbacks, they're really leading the effort. One in six of them, you get fired, you know, for leading the unionization effort. And that scares the bejesus out of the other workers. Like, if Johnny or Jill, who had, you know, who are courageous and they were leading, if they're fired, I'm not going to lift my head above the parapet and try to continue this unionization effort. So, and the penalty for illegally fire, you know, under American law, it's illegal to fire a worker for supporting a union, for campaigning for a union. But if an employer fires someone for supporting a union, it's done all the time, the employer can't even be fined. There's like no penalty. The worst that could happen is, you know, if it took a year for the National Labor Relations Board to get this worker reinstated and the worker lost $20,000 in pay, well, then you have to pay, then the employer has to pay the $20,000. Meanwhile, by keeping out a union and preventing the workers from getting a 5% raise, the company might save $1 million or $2 million. Who knows?
Right. So it's treated as an individual case of an individual wage issue rather than a more global issue of organizing the plan. Yeah.
I mentioned Biden is pushing for this PRO Act, you know, which would make it easier to unionize. It would, for the first time in American history, under federal law, allow fines against companies for, you know, firing people for wanting to have a union. And I should also mention, so going back into history, Lyndon Baines Johnson in the 1960s, Jimmy Carter in the 1970s, Bill Clinton in the 1990s, and Barack Obama, more recently, they all pushed for laws to make it easier to unionize. And each time they failed to enact them because they couldn't get the 60 votes in the Senate because of the Republican filibuster. So it's not that unions surrendered. It's that in, you know, 83 different ways, the system is stacked against unions that makes it harder to unionize. And I think Joe Biden sees that more than Obama, more than any president perhaps since Roosevelt. And he's trying to fix that. And guess what? The Republican Party, which relies so much on corporate donations, will fight tooth and nail against making it easy to unionize. Also because unions often favor Democrats.
Yeah. One thing we left out, by the way, in that many different explanations of why this happened was the fact that the Republicans did not campaign on we're anti-union. They campaigned on we're anti-abortion. They campaigned on we're strong on guns. In other words, if in all those red states you could win elections on social issues, the person voting against their interests, the worker voting against their right to unionize, their ability to have any strength as a union, thinks they're voting for some social value, when in fact, they're voting against themselves.
And the Republicans do a great job in, you know, framing the debate. So Trump, you know, said, oh, the Democrats were what created NAFTA. You know, it's Bill Clinton's fault and it's Obama's fault for trying to get other trade deals approved. So who was the president who negotiated NAFTA? It was George H.W. Bush. And then Clinton, who tried to be a good bipartisan president, said he pushed to get NAFTA confirmed by the Senate. A lot of unions, a lot of Democrats were against that. Clinton got it enacted, but twice as many Republicans voted to confirm NAFTA, to approve NAFTA in the Senate and the House as Republicans. So, like, even though the Democrats keep getting blamed for NAFTA, it was really the Republicans who were the main force behind it. But, you know, Trump, you know, like, fooled all these workers into thinking, I'm your great friend, you know, I'm going to do much more than the Democrats. But Trump and his judicial appointees and his National Labor Relations Board probably took 20, 30, 40 actions that made it harder to unionize. They reduced the number of inspectors for the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Agency to its lowest level in about 40, 50 years. They really reduced the number of fines against employers who broke the law. They made it easier for Wall Street firms to take advantage of workers in the 401ks. Just, you know, Trump does this great PR that he's a friend of workers. And, like, you know, in so many different ways, he betrayed workers.
Oh, no question.
I mean, look at what happened with meatpacking plants.
Oh.
I mean, what happened there was this humongous scandal where thousands and thousands of meatpacking workers were getting COVID. And OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Agency, was just totally asleep at the wheel. So if there were a president who truly cared about workers, he would have said, holy cow, let's fix this. Instead, he said, we're not going to allow any meatpacking plants to close even when they have serious COVID problems. They have to stay open. I mean, how can a president show greater contempt
yes.
for the well-being of workers?
Yeah, I mean, and in other words, remember, he did almost nothing in the whole COVID time. I mean, there were right. very few things he did, but that was one thing he did choose to do. The path forward. What are you betting on? A, there's like the pie in the sky, if only this could happen, but B, there's got to be like a feeling that if we can win this one and this one and this one, then we begin to move, that sort of thing. What's your vision for if we were to move successfully over the next few years?
Great question. I see two different tracks. You know, I had written op-eds saying the Democrats should adopt a, you know, American workers, a contract for the American worker that would call for maybe a $15 minimum wage, a paid sick days law, a paid vacation law, a paid parental leave law, universal health coverage, that, you know, now corporations can ban their employees from going to work for competitors. They're called non-competes, which is horrible because, like, you know, if you want to go work across the street for a competitor and get a $3 wage increase, you know, they can ban you from doing that. And, like, in this contract for the American worker, they should pass that. And I think the Democrats should try to enact these things across the board. And just like this new terrific idea to have $300 a month, you know, per kid in the nation, the Democrats have been pushing that, you know. I think the Democrats have to really do something to show working families, we are fighting for you and we will deliver for you. And I don't think they've done enough of that. And Biden sees the importance of delivering, whether it's the $1,400 or these new child subsidies or the $15 minimum wage. So that's one track. And I think if the Democrats do that, they will win more support among workers and will help be able to keep power. Now, then the other thing where there's a huge problem where I say the system is broken is that workers have so little voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be great to increase worker power if Congress enacted a law to make it easier to unionize. Because, you know, if you're serious about giving workers more power and more dignity and respect, it's important to make it easier to unionize. If you get rid of the filibuster, then try to enact a law to make it easier to unionize. Some people say we in the United States should do what exists in Germany. There's something called works councils, which are yep. very straightforward. At every workplace, there's a council with representatives of blue-collar workers and white-collar workers and management, and they sit down and they discuss safety issues or the speed of the production line or how respectful or not respectful managers are being towards workers. And I think it gives workers a voice. And I think that would be one way. Another good idea, I think, and Elizabeth Warren has been pushing this, is to allow American workers to elect representatives to corporate boards. And you know, that exists in Germany and many other countries in Europe, and that empowers workers. You know, why have corporations in Germany done far, 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 far less outsourcing of factories to other countries than American companies have? I think a big, big reason is German workers have a major voice on German corporate boards. In the US, American workers have very little voice. And I think Warren's idea to have American workers elect 40% of the representative of the board members on corporations with more than $1 billion in revenues a year, I think that would make a big difference, because too often corporate boards, corporate executives just ignore what's good for workers. They figure we could just steamroll them. We don't have to listen to them. But if you have corporate boards where 40% of the directors are representative workers, I think that will change the conversation in a serious way. It might even persuade some companies to stop fighting against unions so damn hard. They might recognize, hey, it's not the end of the world if workers have a real voice. That could lead to more productivity. It could lead to less turnover.
Let me jump in just for a second, because this proposal of what goes on in Germany, I've been talking about from the moment that I learned that existed, which is that over there, I think it's companies with over 2,000 employees.
Yeah. Co-determination.
Nearly half the board has to be elected by the workers. It's the law. And let's remember, Germany does just fine economically, does just fine. Its manufacturing sector still is vital and
it
powerful.
It does better. It does a lot better than just fine. Yeah. And I should also note, so yes, on one hand, it sounds like pie in the sky to enact a law that would require corporations to let their workers elect 40% of the boards. But, you know, public opinion shows that by like 55% to 27%, like 2-1, Americans support that idea. I think in their gut, Americans realize that workers have too little power. And I think they want to fix that. And one of the ways I think they could fix it is passing a law that would allow workers to elect directors to corporate boards. Now, is corporate America going to give a big smile and say, yes, we'll let you do that? No, they'll fight tooth and nail because they like retaining all the power.
But the optics, if you will, the political picture there of the thing being workers should have a voice in their corporation and corporations saying, no, you shouldn't. I mean, it seems like at a time like this, when we've become more aware of who workers are and how necessary they are, perhaps there's a way of viewing that where that doesn't look so good for the corporation.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Elizabeth Warren was calling for this. Tammy Baldwin, the senator from Wisconsin, was pushing for this. You know, maybe Joe Biden could be persuaded to push for this. And like, you know, it's so helpful if the conversation changes. I mean, if, you know, Biden has been very good about talking about every American should have a livable wage, a living wage. You know, every American should earn at least $15 an hour. He says, you know, workers should have a greater voice in where they work. We should empower unions. But there are other ways of talking about giving workers a greater voice and greater power, whether it's electing people to corporate boards or having works councils. Mm-hmm. I think all these, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom. I think all these ideas can be and should be discussed, especially now with Democrats in control, with a worker-friendly person in the White House. I know a lot of leftists will say, oh, Joe Biden isn't as lefty as progressives we like. But I've spoken to some progressives who say the policies Biden has been pushing are hardly any different than Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren would have been pushing had they been elected, you know, whether on the $15 minimum wage, whether on strengthening unions, whether on fighting global warming. He's been pushing very far and fast to try to help workers in the United States and much more than I thought Obama was trying. And
yes,
I think that's very promising. He shows, he shows he cares about workers and he values what they do. And I think that subtly is emboldening and empowering workers. And the question is, you know, once we get past the pandemic, and during the pandemic, we've really realized and honored essential workers for the great work they do. What's the next step to empowering workers and creating a fairer society where workers have more dignity? And I think Biden is looking for that. And I think his economic advisors are looking for that. And Marty Walsh, his labor secretary, and Julie Hsu from California, his deputy labor secretary, will all be brainstorming ideas to make things better for workers, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that the moment is right. And as you know, you mentioned somewhere, there's like sort of three ways this could go, that somehow all this interest and all this motivation gets tamped down and things stay the way they are, or there is a resurgence of workers and labor, or it's some mix in between. So again, the book is Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. It really does tell lots of stories, the stories of what labor once was, how it got beaten down, not surrendered, but bulldozed, and then the signs, even before the pandemic, even before the Biden presidency, of how things have been, they don't get much publicity, but how things have been looking up. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or a world that just might work. That's all one word, a world that just might work. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues and usually 8 or 10 articles that sort of flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and most other podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site. They'll be searchable. You can follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Stephen Greenhouse, and keep up your good work.
Thanks very much.